The following program comes to you as part of the Africa Health Network, a service of the Voice of America to our audience throughout the African continent.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lee Normoudou, and welcome to Health Chat. Last week, leaders and activists gathered in New York City for the 69th United Nations General Assembly. The UNGA kicked off with the climate summit, and several topics were on the agenda during the week, including the Ebola crisis and malaria. I spoke with some of the key players in the global health community who attended, including Ray Chambers, the United Nations Secretary General's Special Envoy for Financing the Health Millennium Development Goals, or MDG, as well as for malaria. Here is an excerpt of our discussion.
We've seen that the world has gone through a financial crisis, and as someone who has been really overseeing financing the MDG, especially health, how much of an impact has the crisis had on gathering funding to finance the MDGs?
It was a setback in the years 2008, 2009, and 2010. And then we began to see a financial recovery, and more money started coming back into the system to help end poverty and to help achieve the Millennium Development Goals. I personally don't believe that we're back up to the level we were before 2008. And the developing countries, like the African countries, growing with their GDPs, really been helpful. I'm very fearful that unless Ebola is brought under control, that can reverse the economic growth of the developing countries, which I think is more important than the economic growth of the developed countries.
Quickly about malaria, where do we stand as of now, and what's the way ahead?
Well, we've reduced child deaths in sub-Saharan Africa from 1.2 million a year to less than 400,000. We're hoping to get to less than 100,000 by the end of 2015. We've had some financial hurdles. We hope the announcement today is going to push us over the top. But again, in a country like Liberia, we've been regressing on malaria because people are afraid to go to the doctor with fevers, fearing they'll be diagnosed with Ebola and sent to a quarantine clinic. So we have to ratchet up our communications to encourage people to be examined, even with the fear they could be diagnosed with Ebola.
And finally, can you just go over the announcement today again, please?
I can't. It's embargoed.
Okay.
But there's going to be an announcement, a multi-billion dollar commitment to push us over the Millennium Development Goals.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chambers.
And climate change, which was on the agenda at the UNGA, has been blamed by experts for some environmental challenges such as global warming, and has also been linked to some health problems. Today we will discuss the health impact of climate change, and joining us via phone from Washington, D.C. is Julie Turton. Ms. Turton is the One Health Lead for NOAA, responsible for developing and implementing the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration health strategy across NOAA and with other federal, state, local, and international agencies, academic, and private sector partners. Ms. Turton, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here and for covering this important topic.
It's great to have you. And climate change, we've heard about it in the past. Some people believe that it's a reality. We need to do something about it. Some other people are very skeptical. So help us to understand, what is climate change? When we talk about this, what are we specifically looking at?
Okay. So this is obviously not the first time I've heard this question, and I have a couple of answers here. There are a couple of different parts of this answer. One is to think about climate as a continuum from weather to seasonal change to 10-year called decadal changes to longer-term climate change, more 50 to 100 years out. So there's a continuum of how our climate is changing some of it is natural and some of it is modulated by our human activities. And the concern about climate change per se is that what we're doing is modulating our environment and making it change more rapidly than we are expecting it to, and then we can adapt. So part of it is to think about climate as a continuum from weather, which is basically what you see tomorrow and helps you decide whether you're going to take an umbrella or wear a, you know, take a parasol. Climate is what lets you know whether you need to be buying more umbrellas in general or planning for drier conditions. So that's the basic tenet of what we're talking about. So I think continuing to think about it as a continuum from climate to weather and back is important.
So we've also seen that some people like to refer to it as climate disruption. Is it, to what extent is it different?
I'm not sure that it is particularly different. Mm-hmm. I think what we see in terms of the science knowledge on this is a couple of things. Changing climate is a given. You have thousands of scientists around the world who collaborate on this intergovernmental panel of climate change to determine how the climate is changing and what the drivers are. And that is largely a consensus document, and there is unequivocal evidence that the climate is changing. So you get thousands of scientists around the world that are looking at that. That is a science assessment document. And then,
okay.
Mm-hmm. And then we also see there are some basic things that scientists look at that show us that it's changing, like the Arctic sea ice is melting and much more rapidly than we expected. Air temperatures are increasing, leading to increased heat effects, heat waves, droughts, that sort of thing. We expect to see increased extreme weather events, storms, floods, that sort of thing. Sea levels are rising. There are basically 10 signs of a warming world. Those are a few of them. So we measure these things with satellites and on-the-ground observations over, you know, 30 to 150 years. And between the science assessment that is taking place globally and these measurements that take place over decades, if not longer, mm-hmm. That's how we see that the climate is changing.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the impact of climate change on health specifically. What are some of the observations? You talk about the fact that there are two folds to this issue. Climate change is naturally, it's a natural occurrence, but it's also man-made. So if we go by these two factors, how are these impacting people's health?
Well, I think, first of all, you can't really separate them out into two factors. You've got to look at them as the climate is changing, period,
okay.
And how do we adapt to it. And mm-hmm. in terms of health impacts, there are a couple of ways of thinking about it. You've got the direct effects of climate change. So let's say your air temperature is getting warmer. You have more heat waves. You have more air quality problems. Those are more direct effects. And the heat waves and increased degree days, or, you know, the number of days where your nighttime temperatures are higher than they used to be, that affects not just, you know, children in playing fields, but, you know, workers who are out in the field. It affects crop production, all kinds of things. So it isn't just, you know, a heat wave event like you might see in the European and France had. You know, there have been some big heat wave effects, but it can have effects both in developed and developing worlds. So that is one way a direct effect happens. That's one example. The other ways in which climate affects health are a little less direct, and they are through changes in ecological systems. So things like malaria. Malaria is considered a vector-borne disease because it's transmitted by a mosquito.
Mm-hmm.
Cholera is a waterborne disease transmitted by bacteria in the water environment. The ecological systems are affected by climate, and then there's multiple pathways in which those affect human health, both by affecting the mosquito or the vector and by affecting human behavior and other factors that are, you know, not a part of that system, like whether people are moving around, whether they're in an urban environment or a rural environment or moving between the two. So there's a lot of pieces that go into understanding how the ecosystem and ecologically mediated vector-borne waterborne health impacts like malaria, like cholera, and like dengue will actually change. So it's complicated. And then the third piece has to do with food and food security and food ability and the quality and nutritional value of the food.
So. Okay. Now, I have a question from Chinedu in Lagos. He says, we never had Ebola in West Africa until this year. Can this be a result of climate change?
That's a, it's a good question and a very understandable one, and I wish I had an answer. I think when it comes to these, as I mentioned, ecosystem, these ecologically mediated disease, Ebola, as I understand it, and I'm not an Ebola expert, but there is a large habitat issue related to the bats. And certainly climate and weather influence habitat, but they are not the only thing by any stretch that influences the outbreak or spread of Ebola. So climate may contribute, may help us understand. Ideally, we're building early warning systems so we get a better handle on when these outbreaks might happen if there is a climate or weather connection. But right now, I'm unaware of anybody who would say that Ebola was directly related to climate change. It's just too complicated a system.
Yes, and I haven't even seen anything to link the two. For example, last week when we were at the United Nations General Assembly, both topics were on the agenda, but in none of the discussion have I heard any kind of connection. So I guess this is still out to I guess for some researchers to look into. Now let's talk about some of the diseases. You mentioned a few of them: cholera, malaria, and others. Have you seen evidence of some diseases that were not created, but that were just appeared, some diseases that appeared due to climate change? Have there been any evidence-based research that supported that?
Well, again, it's not going to be just directly related to climate change. We see changes in the distribution of ticks, which transmit certain diseases. In the U.S., that happens to be Lyme disease. Climate is one of the drivers, but it is not the only driver. So what you're likely to see, say, take malaria, is a change in the range of where the mosquito can thrive and the temperature at which it thrives. So you might see a change in the range of where malaria can occur. But it will, whether you actually get malaria will depend on whether the people are susceptible, what they've had before, the kind of exposure they have to the mosquito, and the kind of prevention measures they take. You know, if you're using your bed nets or, you know, using insecticides, less likely to actually, you know, get the mosquito bite that would give you malaria. So we do see changes, and we expect to see changes in the range of the vector that carries the disease. This is true for, you know, for dengue, for malaria, for cholera, slightly different vector, but we could see distribution and changes in the range for different reasons. But whether disease actually happens has to do with human exposure and human vulnerability to that factor. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And you mentioned vulnerability. Last week, I spoke to a lady from Papua New Guinea, and she was talking about how their island was literally disappearing. But one of the things that I found striking was the fact that she said that climate change that they were going through was also affecting their immune system.
Yeah. You know, again, that is one of the things, and people, the comment about immune system is actually a very good one. And let me first preface it by saying I'm not a hardcore epidemiologist, but I do know that the immune status of a population or a person has a lot to do with whether you're going to get an infection, especially with something like dengue. It's, you know, what you've had before, and that sort of thing. But I think the other piece is, you know, one of the questions we're asked is what can you do about protecting yourself? And whether climate directly affects immune status, it could have an impact through the nutritional quality and the food supply and maybe exposure and overall stress.
Yes.
But those are a little speculative. But what we do is...
Hello, Ms. Thornton, are you there? Okay, I think we lost Ms. Turton. Julie Turton is with the National. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Julie Turton, who is with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. We'll be right back to continue our discussion. Don't go away.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
That AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. For those of you joining us late, tonight's topic on Health Chat is the health impact of climate change and the climate and environment was on the agenda last week at the United Nations General Assembly. So we're trying to understand a little better how and to what extent climate change is related to our health. And joining us to understand this is our guest, Julie Moore Turton, and she's the One Health lead for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States. Ms. Turton, thank you for joining us. Sorry, we lost you there for a second.
Glad to be back.
Great. It's good to have you back. So listen, let's talk about specifics when it comes to some of these diseases. I know you worked extensively on cholera. Can you give us a sense of the dynamics around this with regards to cholera?
Absolutely. So I was actually thinking that very thing in terms of specifics. We do see changes in the range and the potential for these various vectors, like the mosquito vectors that transmit malaria and the like. But with cholera, it is a waterborne disease, and it's transmitted in part by these bacteria that live in the marine environment or in a water environment. Cholera itself is a combination of an environmental driver, an environmental change, and poor water and sanitation systems combined. So what we know for the drivers of cholera from the environmental side are sea surface temperature, changes in sea surface temperature, in particular warming, and changes in salinity, and changes in the microbial composition of the water, things that the bacteria feed on, are all drivers that we can predict, that we can observe and predict. So that tells us sort of where the risk for cholera might be coming, and we're working to put these into early warning systems to predict changes in cholera risk or exposure, particularly in areas, coastal areas that are experiencing sea level rise. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of two types of cholera, not really two types, but two environmental types of cholera. One is those that are driven by coastal environment and that would be more affected by sea level rise and directly affected by the temperature and the salinity. And we're, as I mentioned, building systems to use our global Earth observing framework that looks at all these ocean and climate parameters and puts the important pieces into a system that makes links to the cholera outbreak and then feeds that into the decision makers, whether it's the World Health Organization, we're working with them on this project, but it's intended to actually inform the ministries of health in country or at a more subnational level. So that's a sort of a coastal cholera dynamic. We have worked with partners in the European Union that were working with folks from South Africa at CSIR, the Commonwealth of Scientific and Industrial Research, and partners at the Ministries of Health in Uganda on a cholera early warning system that is more of a fresh lake-driven system. And there the inputs are a little bit different, the predictions a little harder, but we're still looking at some of the temperature drivers and whether we can predict cholera in inland systems too. But regardless, we do know that big shifts in temperature, big shifts in rainfall do affect cholera transmission. So we are working very hard to take all this knowledge about what we're observing for the ocean, what we're observing that informs the climate drivers, and to put that into systems to predict risk for cholera. We're doing this for malaria, so you might see something related to an El Nino event that affects the transmission dynamics for malaria. So we're trying to put these pieces together that take what's happening in the ocean, what's happening in the climate, what we can predict for a disease outcome, and put that into a system to help people better prepare for and ultimately reduce the health impact of whatever the disease is.
So what has been the response after you do all this work, preliminary work, and you deliver the results? And what has been the response and or what should be the response?
Sure. Well, let's see. Let's start with malaria, and let me just say these are projects that are done as pilots or in development. We're trying to make this a little bit more robust system, in broader areas or in full-fledged countries. So we're about to launch this, we hope, in Bangladesh for cholera. We have already built some prototype systems for malaria in parts of Africa, and I do know that several years ago, actually, we were working with the malaria control districts in South Africa who were taking the seasonal forecast. Okay, so we did this right before the rainy season and said, you know, your rainy season is going to start a little earlier or a little later, and how would you use this to manage malaria? And the mosquito control districts did take that information, and they did an enhanced bed net campaign and some spraying, I believe. I'm not positive, actually. I was not on the field there. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that in those cases, the mosquito control districts use that. The public health care deliveries and clinics will use the information or have. In fact, the Uganda project that was focused on cholera ended up building a handheld system to just do the basic public health data collection so that they'd know what kind of cases they had and where they were geolocated in time and space, so we could actually build a data set for analysis. So we work with the ministries of health for sure, and the public health decision makers, which are not always just in the ministry, and some of the donor organizations and relief organizations in country. It does vary country to country by who's got what strength. So those are the target audiences. In most cases, those are working. In some cases, they've been pilot projects that are no longer funded, but we are trying to get that whole idea of building a early warning system capacity a little more institutionalized for some of these more prominent big health impacts.
Okay, you mentioned South Africa, and we do have a question from South Africa. Julius wants to know, can climate change lead to cancer? It's a long stretch there, but...
it is. So some of the early work had to do with the more ultraviolet rays coming through and causing increased risk for skin cancer. I think that's pretty well known, and that's why we now all use, or one of the reasons we now all use...
Sunscreen. Sunscreen, yes.
Directly, no, it's not going to cause cancer directly. only as a secondary kind of effect through exposures, and it's definitely not a given. So.
Okay. And Ali in Sierra Leone says, what is the long-term effect of climate change? Can humanity disappear eventually? Well, these are some very interesting questions. I get these calls for your personal opinion. I don't know if any, well, perhaps there are some research out there about humanity disappearing, but I'll let you comment on this if you want.
Sure. Well, actually, it's a fair question. There are things that you can do both to reduce the rate of change, which, you know, the most common one is reducing your production of greenhouse gases. That's not as common an issue in more rural environments than it is in more urban.
I don't mean to cut you, but I'd like to, if you could just explain a little bit, what is greenhouse gas? Because some people might not know. These are so technical sometimes.
The typical one that's talked about in climate change circles is carbon dioxide, but it includes water vapor and methane and a number of other gases that are often production of a result of fossil fuel production. But you know, methane is released in other ways as well. So there are multiple greenhouse gases, and the one that's most commonly identified is carbon dioxide from fossil fuel combustion, which, you know, we do need to, I mean, it's good for the environment. It will help reduce the impact of climate. It's, you know, good for the air quality locally. There are lots of good reasons to reduce, you know, your fossil fuel combustion. Mm-hmm. But I think there are also other things that we can do that are good measures, not just related to reducing climate change, although they may be helpful to more reducing the impact. So if you get back to the climate and health point, let's say that you are worried about meningitis and the meningitis belt in West Africa, when we can to do a better job of predicting the onset of that season, and you can make sure that you take those precautionary measures at a personal level. You know, there are things you can do to empower yourself to take action that enhance your immunity. You know, eat as best you can, make sure that you are taking the, you know, public health measures that are recommended to reduce your risk for, you know, meningitis infection. One of the things that we are worried about a little bit is the complex emergencies, and whether you're in a country like the United States or in a, you know, West African continent or whatever, you have a greater risk of multiple things happening at once that stress our systems more. Again, the idea is stressing more than we're able to adapt.
Multiple things happening at once, such as what?
Multiple things happening at once. Migration, let's say there is a prolonged drought and people are looking for food, and you migrate into an area that has a disease which you don't have, to which you have not been previously exposed, and you therefore don't have immunity. You are therefore more susceptible to getting that disease, not because of climate change directly, but because you've moved in search of food or because of civil unrest or something like that. So there's a complex situation that's emerging, and in the United States, for instance, it's a different set. In other developing countries, it would be a different set of things. For us, it is. We had a situation where we had a huge storm. It's called a derecho, and it took the power out for quite some time, many, many days, and we were dependent on the power. So the people who were actually dependent on that for some of their medical devices ended up suffering. It was in the middle of a heat wave, so air conditioning systems weren't working, and our people were used to them. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's the change from normal that happens more quickly than we can adapt, and the confluence of these events is what we're expecting to try to have to deal with a little bit more so in the future than we are quite adapted to do so now. So the challenge is to take action at a personal level, to do what you can to improve your own health and resilience, to follow the public health messages, which are not just related to climate change, they're just good practice, you know, improve water and sanitation, those sorts of things. And then to be thinking about your risk factors in the context of these other, you know, extreme weather events or earlier onset of storms or prolonged drought, those kinds of things. So it's looking at, again, a continuum of these events.
Okay, and these are some great advice, and I think we're going to leave it there with this advice. And Julie Turton, thank you so much for joining us. That's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. I thank you for your time and your insight on the issue.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Great. And thanks to all of you for tuning in, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. Don't forget to keep the conversation going on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou, in Washington, with producer Jackson Vunganyi. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.